Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott.
I do a lot of seminars, and I do a lot of trainings and things like that where I'm sitting in there and they offer breakfast and they offer lunch and like breakfasts are like, no, I can't have anything that's on that table.
I know. It's almost like, no. And they're like, we have
double
fruit.
No.
And you're like, no, I can't. I know it's an orange. I can't have that.
Keisha Brooker and Catherine Price both have diabetes.
Anytime you go in a coffee shop or, you know, a store, and like for me, it's like, oh, okay, that's an entire case of no. Mm-hmm. I can only have coffee and tea.
Yes.
Keisha and Catherine are taking control of their diabetes, but the illness has taken a lot from them.
Thanksgiving is horrible. I don't even celebrate it anymore. I have lots of siblings that they want to make everything under the sun, and I was like the best baked macaroni and cheese maker in the family, closest to mom's, and sweet potato pie, but you have to taste those things. And I'm like, I can't do this. And it's really hard. I don't go out much. I don't do a lot of celebrations.
I mean, I remember thinking, I remember my blood sugar on my wedding day. It was like 300 something because I had a slice of cake, right? And it's like just all these ways that diabetes affects these moments of our lives.
Yes.
And makes us kind of step away from human connection and things that would otherwise be very meaningful and joyful.
Right.
That other people don't necessarily even recognize that we're stepping away from.
Today's episode is about the cost of diabetes. It's an expensive illness to treat, but for this hour, we're not talking money. We're talking about how it changes people's lives. What does it mean to have to say no all the time, to feel lousy, to have people judge you? How does it affect people's ability to get jobs? There's no cure for diabetes. You have to manage it with medication, constant monitoring, and a pretty strict diet. If you don't do that, the complications can be serious, even deadly. So when a new treatment comes down the pipeline, people get excited, especially when that treatment sounds like it could be life-changing.
Today, we're going to explain the difference between the disappointing goals and results of conventional diabetes therapy and the remarkable outcomes when the artificial pancreas system is added.
That's the beginning of an advertisement video from a company called Trina Health. They have made big headlines in recent months. Liz Tung explains why.
Trina Health launched its first clinics around 2011. And from the beginning, it was promising big things. The company said its treatments could reverse serious diabetes complications, lost sight, heart disease, liver failure. Within a few years, Trina was a full-blown franchise, with more than a dozen clinics across the country offering their treatment. Patients on social media and online forums hailed it as a miracle. And then came this news.
Serious federal indictments are down for longtime state representative Jack Williams, lobbyist Marty Connors, and healthcare CEO Ford Gilbert.
Ford Gilbert is the founder of Trina Health. He was recently arrested for bribing legislators in Alabama
to push a bill through the legislature that would require Alabama insurance giant Blue Cross Blue Shield to cover treatments at his three Alabama clinics.
Hammond reports flooded the media, calling Trina a scam, an example of the worst abuses in our healthcare system. Despite that, at least some of the clinics have stayed open for business, including a new one in New York City called the Diabetes Relief Center. So a few days after news of Ford Gilbert, the Trina CEO's arrest, I jumped on a Greyhound to check it out.
So I'm standing at Grand Concourse and East 149th Street.
The Diabetes Relief Center is in the South Bronx, an area experts have called the epicenter of the diabetes epidemic. Standing at the corner, it's obvious how important neighborhood is when it comes to diabetes.
Down the street, Dunkin' Donuts, there's a Popeyes, Burger King, past that. McDonald's.
It's a busy area, crowded and noisy. But step inside the glass doors at 2825 3rd Avenue, and suddenly, it's quiet. Riding the escalator up, I start getting nervous. I'm visiting this clinic uninvited and unannounced just a few days after the guy who invented their treatment was arrested for fraud. I have visions of the staff throwing me out, but when I step into the office...
Hi, my name is Liz. I'm a reporter from...
The women at the desk are super nice. They call in their public relations guy, John Schulenberg.
I'm sorry to just drop in.
Well, I'm sorry because there's not much you can see right now.
It's still pretty early, maybe 11-ish. But John says the clinic's head doctor will be in around 3.
If there's a chance that you can come back then,
okay.
And talk to them and patients are
just... As I'm packing up, I meet a guy with silver hair and a rolling suitcase.
Hey, Luz! How you doing?
You seem like you're a regular here.
Well, actually, my first day was yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I took the train down from Boston.
His name's Frank. He asked that I not use his last name to protect his medical privacy. And he came down specifically to try out the treatment. Frank's got good doctors up in Boston, but he's still struggling to manage his condition.
I'm a diabetic with a very high level of insulin resistance.
Serious cases like Frank's can mean you're at risk for heart attack, stroke, or Frank's biggest fear, kidney failure, all of which Frank's hoping to avoid by coming here.
If it has the effect that I'm hopeful for, it can change your life.
Just then, a nurse calls him in.
We ready?
We agree to talk later, and I head to a coffee shop to wait. I've got a few hours, so I figure I'll look back at some Trina videos. Here's one featuring indicted CEO Ford Gilbert.
The Trina Health treatment is the only clinically proven, safe, and effective way to slow, stop, and reverse the chronic complications of diabetes.
Ford Gilbert, by the way, is not a medical doctor. He's a lawyer. And the story goes that he developed the treatment himself after his daughter Trina was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. The videos make this big deal about Trina's treatment being different from conventional therapy, but they do have one thing in common. Both revolve around insulin. So some quick background. Conventional treatment involves injecting insulin several times a day into the tissue right below your skin so that it diffuses slowly into your body. But with Trina, a pump delivers the insulin directly to your bloodstream in these little pulses that are designed to imitate the pancreas. The result, according to Trina...
Insulin reaches the liver quickly and it bursts, awakening the liver to stimulate the production of metabolic enzymes.
This is basically the big idea of Trina's treatment. The way they explain it, imitating the pancreas creates a chain reaction in the body that reconditions your metabolism so that it's better able to handle sugar. Trina doesn't exactly say that it can cure diabetes, but it does say it can reverse some of its causes and most dangerous complications, which sounds pretty incredible. And I'm not the only one who thinks so.
I was, astounded by how outrageous their claim seemed.
That's endocrinologist Jill Crandall. She works at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, also in the Bronx, and is a longtime diabetes researcher. I asked her if the Trina treatment seemed legit, and her answer was a decided no.
They show these very impressive-looking pictures on their website of advanced neuropathic complications, ulcers, and other problems with the feet that seem to be cured following their treatment. And there's just absolutely no evidence to support that at all.
Jill says the Diabetes Relief Center makes it all seem so appealing.
It's so simple. This is all you have to do, and your problems are over. And I think people are desperate for an answer, for a solution like that.
The Diabetes Relief Center's website says their treatment is covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and most major insurers. But back in 2009, the agency that oversees Medicare and Medicaid said there's no clear evidence that the treatment works. When I called recently, the agency didn't answer my questions about their current payment policy, but we do know that it isn't approved by the FDA. If you read through the Trina website, though, you might come away with that impression. What is approved by the FDA? Insulin. Which Jill says any doctor can prescribe in any way they see fit. So calling the treatment FDA approved, she says it feels like a deliberate misrepresentation.
So how they get away with it? I think they're skirting the law, and I think also they're targeting vulnerable populations.
Around 3, I head back to the Diabetes Relief Center, determined to ask some tough questions. What proof do they have that their treatment works? And how do they justify their claims about FDA approval and widespread insurance coverage? But back at the center, everything seems so professional and pleasant. I can feel my resolve starting to melt, as the center's PR guy, John Schulenberg, walks me into their treatment room.
Sure, we have an open area of about 5,000 square feet that actually fronts onto 3rd Avenue.
It's spacious and modern, like medical care from IKEA. And at the center of all of it, 8 patients sitting on royal blue recliners as IVs send pulses of insulin into their blood. I approach a middle-aged woman with an eye patch. Her name's Jenny Malang, and she's about 12 weeks into treatment.
I was diagnosed in December with as being legally blind, and my vision has improved since I've been on this program. So I'm happy about that, because that was the goal. That was my main goal.
Jenny comes once a week. She says each session takes 4 or 5 hours, but Jenny likes the visits. She says she feels taken care of.
The nursing staff is fantastic. They really are.
A team of 4 nurses runs around taking vitals, adjusting IVs, dispensing crackers and juice in case of dipping blood sugar. It's like mom fussing over you when you're sick. Over by the sitting area, Frank, the guy I met earlier who came down from Boston, has finished his treatment and is talking about the fear that brought him here.
I'm going to be one of their toughest cases.
He's got high glucose levels, which over time can destroy your kidneys.
And then you're essentially in dialysis for the rest of your life. So really trying to avoid that.
Frank's been on the conventional treatment route for a while. He's got heavyweight doctors in Boston and Baltimore, but they seem suspicious of the Trina treatment, which is why Frank says he's not telling his doctors back home. He wants to figure out first if it's working.
Because I travel a lot, I'll probably do the next 2 in San Diego. There's a clinic there. I'm hoping that maybe someday soon there'll be one in Boston.
Just then, the center's chief medical and science advisor arrives.
Hi.
This is Dr. Jack Lewis.
Nice to meet you.
Hi.
He's the guy I've been waiting for all day.
Let's go back to the break room.
The guy who I'm thinking should be able to tell me once and for all whether this treatment actually works.
I'm John, but I go by Jack. So it's Jack Lewin, MD.
Jack's a doctor, a cardiology specialist, not a diabetes specialist, but he's got tons of other credentials.
A lot of public health. I ran the whole.
He's chair of the National Coalition on Healthcare, has testified before Congress. He was even considered for Surgeon General under Bill Clinton.
Seen healthcare from a lot of angles.
As we get settled in the clinic staff room, he tells me about what attracted him to the treatment.
Very, very positive, stunning reactions of patients that I've interviewed. And I can't get that out of my mind.
But when I press him about what other doctors like Jill Crandall have said, that there's no evidence showing this actually works, Jack begins to hedge.
Well, you know, again, this is anecdotal, okay? Because this is not science, because you've got to have a control group, you've got to do all that stuff.
In other words, the treatment hasn't been proven, at least not by the kinds of high-quality studies the medical world requires. That's why Jack says he's here, to carry out a research project that shows how and why the treatment works. But these people here today, they're not part of a study. They're just patients who Jack says get charged $375 for each treatment session.
So then I guess my question is, why not start with the study rather than start with the clinics? Because people are paying for this, right?
And that's a reasonable question. I can't answer that question. My role is not to, I'm not part of the clinic. I'm part of the research.
Jack gives a similar answer to my questions about the clinic's connection to the larger Trina Health Company.
Well, see, I'm a consultant here, so I'm not part of this. Yeah, I'm just an independent guy who's doing this work because I believe in it.
We finish up, and as I'm putting away my recording gear, I spot a chart on the wall. The title, Get to Goal, 84 Treatments Per Week. And below that, a graph. The zagging line going up, that's the number of treatments the clinic has delivered over the past few months. Another zagging line, this one headed down, represents the number of empty chairs. It looks like they're a little behind where they want to be, but the clinics clearly got high hopes, and so do their patients.
Liz Tong reported this story, and since she visited the Diabetes Relief Center in the Bronx, they called her to tell her they've cut ties with Trina Health. The Trina logos and several of the biggest health claims are gone from the website. The staff at the Diabetes Relief Center say they're still offering a version of the treatment Liz described in her story, but they're tweaking the way they deliver it. We're talking about diabetes, an illness that will change your life. Both Keisha Brooker and Catherine Price know this. Keisha is 45 years old. She is a community health worker in Philadelphia.
I've had type 2 diabetes since I was 25 years old.
Catherine is 39. She is a science writer.
I've had type 1 diabetes since I was 22 years old.
Keisha was told she was pre-diabetic at first.
And I'm like, well, what is that? What is a pre? So
she was healthy and athletic, so she didn't think this was a big deal.
My doctor told me that, you know, just stay on a good diet and watch what you eat. This time I was like 110 pounds, and I'm like, watch what I eat, stay on a diet. Like,
oh, that's
I'm gonna disappear. So.
But when she started having children, things got more serious.
And by this time I was about 100 and maybe 80 pounds. So each pregnancy I gained about 40 or 50 pounds.
Catherine started having weird symptoms in her early 20s. She was so thirsty all the time.
Up to the point that I was getting up in the middle of the night and drinking out of the faucet in the dorm's bathroom. And
wow.
I was actually dreaming about soda. And I don't normally drink soda, but I was having these like weird fantasies of like sparkling things with ice cubes. And I was hungry all the time.
She was forgetting stuff and acting strangely.
I have this vague memory of being at a party and sitting underneath a table eating a loaf of bread, which is not my normal MO in any circumstance, and I hadn't been drinking. It was just very weird. So I went to the health center and I wrote down all these symptoms, and I now know, like, if someone writes down all those symptoms, they're basically presenting the most classic case of type 1 diabetes ever, but I had no idea.
With both type 1 and type 2, the body has trouble controlling blood sugar levels. But after that, there are lots of differences. With type 1, your body stops making insulin and you have to inject it. With type 2, the more common version, your body doesn't use insulin properly. In terms of cause, diet and obesity are contributing factors with that type. We brought Catherine and Keisha into the studio to talk about their experiences and to tell each other what it's like to live with their type of diabetes.
So how are you with checking your blood sugars? Does that worry you sometimes when you have to check?
Well, it drives me crazy. I actually have a continuous glucose monitor, so I have this pump, this insulin pump, which is conveniently my bra that I just pulled out, but we're getting personal here. So, you know, as you know, I have type 1 diabetes, so that means that I've got an autoimmune disease where for some reason no one can fully explain my body killed off the cells that make insulin, so I don't make any insulin. So I have to take artificial insulin or I die, which is kind of crazy for me to think about because it was only discovered in 1922. So, you know, any time before,
wow.
Before then, I just would be dead. I mean, there's so many reasons I feel like I shouldn't exist right now, but so insulin is just a constant, and I take it through this insulin pump that I'm keeping right now in my bra, but it also is hooked up to this continuous glucose monitor because I have to check my blood sugar. I mean, before I had this continuous monitor, I'd check probably like 12 times a day, so a lot. It was like a lot of checking with finger sticks. And with the continuous monitor, I can see a little graph that kind of shows where I am.
Okay.
Because as you know, I mean, the goal is to keep your blood sugar in this like super tightrope range where it's not too high because that's how you get complications like the blindness and the amputations, and then not too low because then you can pass out and die on the spot. So one thing I think is really interesting would think type 1 in particular, but for anyone who's on insulin, is that insulin is a deadly medication. I mean, it's so dangerous. I have had moments where I've accidentally given myself too much and realized that I very well could have killed myself if I didn't realize it. And it's like, what other medication would a doctor send a patient home with to guess at their doses? I mean, I don't take consistent amounts. I have to guess it for every meal. And anytime I get it wrong, I could end up in the emergency room or worse. And it's kind of overwhelming when I actually think about that. And I'm wondering, can you tell me a bit more about type 2 and then what some of the challenges are for you?
Well, for type 2, so I'm still a little confused on what's going on with my body.
Mm-hmm.
I check my sugars twice a day with a glucose meter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just before breakfast and before dinner. If they're fine, I'm fine. The only thing is, with type 2 diabetes, you're on pills. And when you check your blood sugar and it's 200, it's just 200.
Right, you're not going to be able to do anything about
it. It's nothing, you know. So it's just there. And then you're hoping it goes down. So I used to be afraid to check it. And it's hard to not check it, but it's hard to check it, because if you check it and it's high, you want to starve yourself for the rest of the day. If you check it and it's normal, you're like, yay, now I can eat something. Or if you check it and it's low, you're eating a lot more. And it's just like a roller coaster.
Oh my God, I use the exact same word. It's like chasing your yes. blood sugar. It's like, yeah, for me, it's too high. If it's too high, I can do something. I take insulin. But then if I overshoot that, then it like plummets.
Yeah.
And you can actually see on the little graph on my continuous glucometer, it sometimes looks like a roller coaster because it goes up and down. And I don't know about you, I'd be interested in your thoughts about this, but I feel like it's such an emotional disease and people don't really recognize that part of it, where there's so much self-judgment and criticism. And I think of it like if you had to get on the scale, like however many times a day, and you're, of course it's just a number, but of course you're gonna have an emotional response. So it's like the feeling that you did something wrong, or but you can't do anything about it. And even if you get it right, you don't know if it's gonna be right the next time. I mean, I feel like diabetes can really promote thinking about eating in a way people don't really recognize.
Now that you said that, it really could. My appetite has decreased a lot. But when I get on that scale now and I see that I'm doing more walking and I'm doing, you know, I have changed my eating habits and the numbers are going down, I'm a little excited to get on. But that weekend when I overdid it and then I gained that couple ounces, and it's like, oh, gosh. What did I do to myself? And mm-hmm. that's where you get your self-judgment at.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's Keisha Brooker and Catherine Price talking about living with diabetes. Keisha has type 2, Catherine type 1. We'll hear more from them later on. This illness can also affect your ability to get work. You're not supposed to be fired because you have diabetes, but will you get hired for a job in the first place? Alan Yu looked into it.
If you have diabetes, here in America, there are some jobs you're probably not going to get. You can't join the Coast Guard, the Army, any branch of the military. Sometimes it's possible to get a special waiver, but generally, the policy is no. Right now, the military can simply disqualify you if you have diabetes and need insulin. Adam Roth knows this. He's been rejected from several branches of the military because he has type 1. Adam's in great shape. He'd already done the sit-ups, the push-ups, the running, the monkey bars to pass the military's physical tests.
The course isn't, it doesn't make exceptions for diabetics. Everyone's treated the same.
Right now, he works in Dubai. That's where I reached him.
There is a lot of, running around. There's an obstacle course. You're crawling under the barbed wire and all the things that people see in movies.
One recruiter tried to sneak him in.
I recall one recruiter telling me, hey, just don't tell them that you're diabetic, and then maybe they'll find out while you're already in and you'll be able to stay. And, I'm sure they had good intentions, but, obviously that would be, criminal in lying on my application.
Adam did eventually get a job in law enforcement. Later, he joined the security detail for the Secretary of Commerce. He polices exports, so he has a job that he likes, but he still has to deal with what other people imagine having diabetes is like. One time, several years ago, he was traveling to Singapore to prepare for a visit from the Secretary of Commerce. It's a long flight, so he made sure one of his fellow security guys knew he has diabetes.
I said, look, if I start, acting a little strange, please just give me a piece of candy. He said, oh, no, it's okay. I know exactly what to do. Show me where your medicine is. I'll give you a shot. How many units do I need to give you? And I said, no. That would actually make me worse. Please don't give me any injections of anything. And really just give me a piece of candy and I'll be totally good to go in minutes.
Adam says he could see the other guy was expecting something much more dramatic.
It was disappointing that like a Tootsie Roll would be all I needed to be saved.
So this is the kind of thing that people with diabetes have to deal with. Perception problems. People misunderstand what their needs are, how sick they are, whether or not they can do their jobs. Thomas Lindley has had to deal with that. He's a 67-year-old truck driver in Arizona. He was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes 10 years ago. That didn't disqualify him from the job. He kept on working. He exercised a lot more. He made other changes for his health.
I had to give up donuts, and I'd been a law enforcement officer for quite a few years, and that was a hard one.
Thomas kept driving, and he says there were no problems. But then his company got bought out, and that company considered him a safety risk. So the new company didn't let him drive. He wasn't making any money. So he thought he would apply for disability benefits.
Their insurance company that provided short-term disability said, no, he's completely safe to drive and it's legal for him to drive. You need to put him back on the board and let him go back to work. And they said, no, we're not going to do it. He's unsafe. And it was an argument, and I was caught in the middle.
Thomas is now suing that trucking company for discrimination. In a statement, the company says what happened to Thomas was a safety issue and that, quote, we feel very strongly that we did not treat him in any way unfairly or unlawfully. Greg Paul is Thomas's attorney. He has diabetes himself.
The heart of the Americans with Disabilities Act is to do an individualized assessment of a particular applicant or employee.
So companies are supposed to look at you as a person. Can you do the job? If you're waiting tables, can you carry plates of food and serve customers just as well as anyone else? According to the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's what companies should ask. But Greg says sometimes they just have a blanket ban on anyone with diabetes.
I have seen over the years actually letters that come out from employers saying you are not being hired because of diabetes.
Greg says when people hear a no like that, that's when they might end up suing somebody. Here's an example. A pilot is suing the Federal Aviation Administration because the agency has a policy. If you have diabetes and need insulin, you can't be a commercial pilot. The general policy is no. Stay tuned, that's being challenged right now.
Alan Yu reported this story. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about the cost of diabetes. It might cost you your dream job, but then there's also the social cost. The way diabetes can interfere with your life, how you spend your time and your energy, that's something Keisha Brooker and Catherine Price talked about when they sat down for a conversation in our studio. Catherine has type 1 and Keisha type 2 diabetes.
I don't go out much. That's a major effect. I don't do a lot of celebrations. I had a friend stop speaking to me for like 2-3 weeks because I wasn't going anywhere. It also affects me wanting to travel because when you travel, that's what you're doing. You know, you're eating. And so if it affects that too. It affected my birthday. You know, my family threw me a dinner. And I got there and it was like, it was a surprise for me. I didn't know. And it was just food everywhere. Like they had big macaroni and cheese. And I'm like, okay, let me just eat the curry chicken with no rice.
So, you're like, happy birthday to me.
That's my, you know, I'm cutting cake and just passing it along and it's icing on my fingers. And I'm like, no, I can't lick that. I need a napkin. So, but then sometimes I get to the point where I'm like, oh, this little bit of icing is not going to kill me, you know, whereas though it could possibly be, and I don't even know it.
For me, one of the things I get frustrated by with people when they talk about diabetes is they assume the injection is the worst part. They're like, oh my God, you have to give yourself shots. It's so horrible. And I always say, well, if I just had to give myself shots and could have perfect blood sugar, I would give myself 20 shots a day. You know, that's not the challenge. The challenge is never knowing what's going to happen and feeling like you're constantly primed to fail at every time you open your mouth. You can't eat anything. And food becomes this adversarial like enemy you have to be constantly negotiating with.
It's a very complicated. And they just feel like you're lazy. You know, people are lazy with diabetes or they just don't know how to eat. They have bad choices. And it's not really the case. Some of it is hereditary, you know. One of my doctors, well, it was my primary care doctor and not really knowledgeable about diabetes, was just saying, well, this is when I was like heavier. Well, you just lose the weight, you know. Just stop eating cake and cookies and you'll be okay, you know. And I'm like, wow, I never really had cravings for sweets until after I was diagnosed. And that's really weird. Like, But before, I was very athletic. I was in the military for 11 years, and I worked out all the time. It wasn't that I ate whatever I wanted to, and the doctor just made me feel like me getting diabetes was my fault. And it was like, after that, I never saw that doctor again. But that really made me feel bad. And I was younger at the time, so it was like, it stuck with me. Like, it stuck with me, and it was like, well, what are you doing to yourself?
This feeling that it was your fault, you mean?
Yeah, that feeling stuck with me for a long time.
I think that's one really interesting thing about diabetes is this question of what causes it. For type 1, so we get off easier because no one accuses us of getting it on ourselves unless they think you have type 2 and don't realize there's two types of diabetes, because there's no known way, at least, to prevent your body from attacking itself. And I think that it's just interesting to have this disease that's like an invisible disability where I look normal from the outside, and I wouldn't want to not look normal from the outside. I mean, no one stares at me because I've got diabetes, but that means that they don't understand how hard it is. One thing that's really stood out to me through the course of this conversation is how much we have in common, and it's really interesting to hear someone else say things that I have nearly in the exact same words thought myself.
Yes, I believe so. We are a lot alike, which I thought that we were very different as far as type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
That's Keisha Brooker and Catherine Price talking about living with diabetes. Keisha has type 2 and Catherine type 1. More than 30 million people in the U.S. deal with this kind of thing. It's an epidemic that's sweeping the country, changing lives and our healthcare system. But other countries have higher numbers yet. India has been called the diabetes capital of the world. More than 60 million people there have this illness. That's the highest rate globally. Barry Popkin is one of the researchers trying to figure out what's causing this diabetes explosion. He's a nutrition professor at the University of North Carolina. He works at their School of Global Public Health. Barry says that people of Indian descent are genetically predisposed to developing type 2 diabetes, which is related to body fat.
Especially fat around the heart and the liver, what we call visceral fat.
That fat around your heart and liver doesn't necessarily show up on the scale. Sometimes we call this skinny fat or normal weight obesity. Or it shows up only around your middle, that sort of beer belly look. Barry says people from India are more likely to have that kind of skinny fat, and there are evolutionary reasons for that.
Over the last two millennia, Indians shrunk and became very thin because of the density of the population and the seasonal difficulties with hunger and often famines. So that if you were a woman, if you had a very, very low BMI of, let's say, 15, 16, or 17, the kind that some of our gymnasts and ballerinas have, you couldn't ovulate, you wouldn't have babies. In India, they evolved in a way that at very, very thin body weights, all the fat that they had and all the energy went around the heart and the liver, so that the women who were what you would think of as malnourished could have babies.
Barry says they don't fully understand how this kind of body fat contributes to diabetes risk. But what they do know is this. Even if you have a low body mass index, if you are Indian, you are much more likely to develop type 2 diabetes than other ethnic groups. That, combined with major lifestyle changes in India, has made for a toxic combination.
All of a sudden, India's gone through rapid economic change, a rapid nutrition transition where they eat and drink more like us. A third of them now eat a lot of dairy, and it's very high-fat dairy. And now more and more are eating processed food that's not healthy, what we would call junk food and beverages. As a result, all their weight gain has first come around the heart and the liver. And that has what has increased this huge risk of diabetes and this huge increase in diabetes in the population.
How is the country dealing with this onslaught of diabetes? It's expensive to treat.
It's very expensive. It's terribly expensive. Right now, what they're finding is that low-income Indians are beginning to get overweight and obese and that this is really hitting them. And they're just not being treated. And the government has been very slow to react. They have, in the last year, changed the tax system. And they are taxing packaged food, and they put an extra 12% tax on carbonated sugary beverages. So that's step one. But they need to do a lot more, and they're only beginning to talk about it in the health side. The rest of the government hasn't touched it.
So it sounds like there could be lots and lots of people in India who don't know that they have diabetes.
Right, right. In India, I would suspect that probably 1% or 2% of low-income Indians know that they have diabetes but have it. And we see a lot of deaths from it starting to be reported. But no, the government is not yet really going after this.
That sounds overwhelming.
It is overwhelming because you've got 1.3 billion people in that country, and it's growing, and it will soon become the largest country in the world. And you've got half to two-thirds of them have no access or minimal access to health care and don't have the funds, and the government doesn't have the money really to treat everybody with insulin and so forth and to keep them healthy. So we are at a point where India's on a collision course with its non-communicable diseases, particularly diabetes.
Barry Popkin is a nutrition professor at the University of North Carolina. He is with their School of Global Public Health. When we were talking, he mentioned that Hispanics in the U.S. are another group with a really high genetic risk for developing type 2 diabetes. The Centers for Disease Control says half of Hispanic men and women in the United States will develop this illness sometime during their lifetime. Texas reporter Kristen Cabrera looked at her father's family, where that number has been more like 100%. She recently gathered her dad, her aunts, and uncles to talk about diabetes.
In the Packers, main little kit, that's the glucometer, the test strips, and the pen needle that pricks my finger.
That's my dad. It's a little after 7 in the morning, and before he goes to work, he checks his blood sugar.
I just pricked my finger to get the blood out, and now I'm going to swipe it over the tester. 154.
Ever since I could remember, my father has had diabetes. I was raised in the Rio Grande Valley, about 5 hours south of Austin. This group of cities is on the Texas-Mexico border, and it's almost 90% Hispanic.
Hi!
All seven of my father's sisters and brothers were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes.
My name is Macario Cabrera Jr.
My name is Blanca Cabrera.
My name's Ari Cabrera.
Hello, I'm Adam Cabrera.
I've had diabetes since 99,
I believe.
Maybe in 2000.
In 1996.
And my father.
Oh, my name is Aaron Lee Cabrera, and I'm the oldest. I'm 61. I was diagnosed with diabetes in 1996.
The family you're not getting to meet, my Theo Edgar, has had diabetes for 18 years. My Thea Yvette had diabetes for 10 years, but back in 2014, she got weight loss surgery, and now she doesn't have diabetes. Carrying extra weight or being obese are big risks. Theo Eliud, the baby brother of the bunch, was diagnosed in 2002 and lived with it for 5 years before he died of colon cancer. Honestly, no one in my family knew about the connections between colon cancer and diabetes, but one study found that patients with diabetes and colon cancer live about 5 years less than people who don't have diabetes.
And it's funny listening to all my brothers and sisters saying when they're diagnosed, it's like we all got diagnosed around the same time.
The American Diabetes Association recommends most people get screened around age 45. In my family, people typically get diagnosed around age 37. Being Hispanic is a risk factor for diabetes, but being of Mexican descent, like we are, is an even higher risk. And that's not the only pattern I noticed.
My blood vessels, I was bleeding from the back of the eye, in other words.
I also have bleeding in my eye.
And that's when he told me that I had a lot of lacerations inside my eye.
Now I've got also diabetic retinopathy, which is it's like the blood vessels are bursting in the back of your eyeball.
It's a scary thing to know your father is bleeding in his eyes. As a family, we're all used to dealing with the complications that come from diabetes, but we really weren't prepared for when my grandmother's health started spiraling after one small cut.
She had a fall, and she cut her toe, and we did not know that she had cut her toe when she fell.
The wound got worse and worse, and it began to sink in for my dad and the rest of the family. The daily drop-ins wouldn't be enough to take care of her anymore. She's going to need 24-hour care in a nursing home.
Mom already had like 3 falls in 1 week, and we had to call EMS because we could not lift her up. She was so heavy.
How heavy?
Oh, she was pretty close to 300 pounds. And her doctor came in, and they decided that they're going to really need to amputate some toes. So after a week, then maybe 2 weeks, they saw that her gangrene had not stopped, and so they figured they had to remove her left leg up to her knee, and that's what happened eventually.
That is the scariest thing to see.
Yeah.
You know, like at the hospital, I work at the hospital, and I had to ask the doctors, do not let me see mom's foot. Ugh, it scares the crap out of me.
Yes, observing mom and the things she went through,
it was
terrible. We all know that we don't want to go that path. As we saw how mom went, you know, suffered, and that's agonizing.
What's the best way to determine why mom went through that? She didn't take care of herself properly. She was always taking insulin. Jenny was always helping her with the insulin. Why?
But she wasn't active. She was not active.
That's the one thing.
That one probably.
She was not active at all.
Yeah, she used to walk.
Yeah. She used to walk.
I don't know what happened. Just one day, she just
went
stopped.
Mom went downhill really after LU died.
That's what I was just about.
She didn't care after that.
Yeah.
Ultimately, my grandmother's complication led to heart failure. She died in January of 2016, and her death affected all of us. And I wondered, would her passing be a warning to my aunts and uncles? Take control of your diabetes.
Seeing what mom and dad were going through and, you know, it was hard. And it was very depressing, I guess. And I guess because of that, I wasn't taking care of myself. So now that mom and dad are gone, you know, and they're in a much better place, now I have to focus on me.
It's like, you know, we all saw mom and dad go through this. We've all thought the same thing. We've even talked about it, you know. And for me personally, and from what I heard from my brothers, we're just exhausted. We're so tired. And I wish I had more energy, you know.
I hope our family talk helped everyone connect the dots a bit. That caring for yourself, your body, your emotions, it all matters when you're trying to live well with diabetes. I definitely see our family patterns in me. Like years of morning breakfast tacos might be looming over me. I'm overweight, I'm heading into my 30s, I don't ever really exercise, but I don't want my DNA to control my destiny.
Kristen Cabrera is a reporter in Austin, Texas. She grew up in the Rio Grande Valley. Kristen's family members were talking about some of the things that can happen when diabetes is not managed. You can lose a limb or your life. For healthcare providers, it can be challenging to find just the right approach to get patients to buy into all the things that need to happen for them to stay healthy. They have to be part enforcer and part cheerleader.
First, I just say take a deep breath.
Amber Wheeler is an endocrinologist at Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco. Most of her patients have diabetes.
There's going to be a lot of information. I'm going to give you as much education as I can today. But, you know, this is a work in progress. This is a marathon, not a sprint. I do find that patients are in different stages of grief sometimes when they do get the diagnosis. Some are already at the point where they have accepted it and they're ready to move forward, but others might have to go through the other stages. They might be in denial about it. They may have some anger.
Anger she can deal with. She brings those patients in a couple of times to help them get through that. Denial is harder when patients keep on living and eating like nothing is wrong.
You can provide as much education, you can try to help them to work through the diagnosis, but it's very difficult to help when they're not quite at the point where they can accept it and move forward.
Amber also has to really get to know her patients to figure out what's going on in their lives.
there are some patients who they're actually not able to read some of the instructions that I give them, and they're not able to understand some of the literature that we provide. So it may be that they need more verbal information about their diabetes.
Or she has to understand why somebody is overeating.
They seek food for comfort. They seek food for depression. So I think we also have to discuss what your relationship with food is and also how that may impact your diabetes.
She recently ran into one of her patients at a grocery store, and she noticed that he was using a benefits card to pay for his food. At the next appointment, she talked to him about the cost of his medications, and she was able to lower that for him. Some of her patients work several jobs, so they have very little time for exercise, and she tries to make suggestions that are doable, that fit into their lives.
When they park their car in their driveway, I say, why don't you just go for a walk around the block for 15 minutes before you walk into the house? I had one patient who she discovered that she really loved to exercise. After I tried to encourage her a little bit to try to get more physically active, she discovered that she loved to do yoga. And then every day she was going to the yoga studio. And that was something that really positively impacted her life.
Amber says her approach is more about high fives and hugs than dire health warnings.
I want to make sure that patients are not in my office and feeling that I'm telling them that they're a bad diabetic and telling them that they're going to lose their foot or that they're going to be on dialysis. I think that sometimes the scare tactics don't work with every patient and that they're going to tune you out before they tune you in. So for every patient, it's a partnership. And if they don't feel invested in me, they can't feel invested in their diabetes either.
Amber Wheeler is an endocrinologist at Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco. Dana Bate produced this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tong. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is the editorial director. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org.